Hi, this is Scriptlock, a podcast about narrative in video games. I'm Nick Folkman.
And I am Max Folkman. Today's episode has Jolie Menzel and Teddy Diefenbach. Jolie is currently a level designer at Ubisoft San Francisco on South Park, The Fractured Butthole. But before that, she was a cinematic artist and game designer at Telltale Games, where she worked on titles including Jurassic Park, The Walking Dead 400 Days, The Wolf Among Us, and Tales from the Borderlands. Teddy is a writer and game designer and has worked on such titles as Pirates of the Caribbean Online, Shove Pro, The Moonlighters, and Hyperlight Drifter. And he's recently joined Square Enix Montreal as a creative director. Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
We'll start out, like always, with how you got into games. So, Jolie, you go first.
All right. Well, as anyone's journey in games, it's pretty cursory. I originally went to art school for fashion design, realized that the people in that major were not the kind of people I wanted to hang out with for the rest of my life. Switched majors to comic books. My degree reads sequential art, which awesome. Is a very fancy name for comic books. So did a lot of visual storytelling stuff. Did a lot of previs work for like kind of student films in the Savannah area, and then tumbled into games because I basically went to GDC with a portfolio full of storyboards, and of all the companies there, BioWare and Telltale cared about that, and I ended up going with Telltale.
Has your work with storyboards helped you with your current work?
It is essential to my current work, actually. My level design process very much is about storytelling, plotting out moments for the player and stuff like that. So, yeah.
Do you still draw?
I do. I storyboard at work. That's definitely, like, as I said, it's a big part of my process and part of my communication with my team members. So I try to draw. I'm in like a little D&D campaign and I draw like a little D&D characters. That's my current art output. So I try to just keep moving on my drawing.
You studied fashion design?
Yeah.
Oh, that's so cool.
Once upon a time.
The careers that will never be for me are fashion, architecture, and product design.
But we do it all, right? Like, that's games.
I mean, we do and we don't. Like, I feel like I don't do fashion design. But yeah, I mean, character artists and stuff do fashion design and work with them, so... I don't know. I'm such a proponent of like, I'd love to work more with architects and stuff, even though they have experience with different spaces. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'm supposed to be answering a question.
Wait, I have a question now for Jolie, quick before you answer. Did your fashion studies, has that helped your work at all?
Oh, yes. I think like Teddy, not so much recently, but when I do kind of my more side work, you know, the idea of silhouetting shapes, posing and stuff like that, that all definitely comes into play. But yeah, I mean, it's all art, right? Like the school I went to had everybody take foundation classes, no matter what your major was. Even game designers had to learn life drawing because it all applies in one way or another.
Good for them.
Yeah.
Okay, wait. I'm going back. How did I get into games? The career path is a little weird. Let's see. I started making video games in college. And then I went into advertising, as you might expect. I left that because I did not want to be there. I learned a lot about production, though. I wanted to be in games. I got like I didn't realize till after all of that that I could even make video games, even though I'd already made video games. Like, I didn't think it was a viable career, especially because I was based out of New York at the time. So I left advertising at some point because I got a job in games. My first job in games was at Game Loft, which is still a mobile games developer primarily, but before smartphones, when I joined, before like the iPhone changed everything, they were the dominant developer on mobile, because in order to be a dominant developer on mobile, you had to have the muscle to port to like 4,000 phones. And nobody had that because there were so many different types of like Nokia phones and things that you just had to have that infrastructure. And if you didn't, you couldn't make games for phones. But then I left Game Loft. Wait, I got fired from Game Loft but not before on a whim applying to and getting accepted to USC Film School for film production, because I got this terrible bug that I wanted to make television. So I applied to the big four film schools.
As a director?
Writer, producer. Right, you know, like a, which is effectively the director for TV, you know.
Yeah.
And then I got fired. I was like, well, this is a good excuse to move across the country. So I did that. And that's, so wait, I'm still not into games. I spent a semester in film school doing all the core stuff and doing my short films and starting with screenwriting. And then I just found more and more that most of the projects I really was hungering to make, like, I just preferred if they were games. I was like, oh, this would be even cooler if it were a game. And so I transferred laterally into the games program at USC, which is part of the cinema school. And I had to convince them to let me do that because no one had done that before. But I'd made a bunch of games, and I made some Game Jam games, so that got me in the door there. And that was officially my, like, okay, now I'm doing games for real, which is funny because my admission essay to the film school had been, I know I've done a bunch of weird stuff, I know I've dabbled in games and advertising, but TV's what I want to do, I'm positive. And then what happened because of the way that the system worked is when I reapplied for the game program, that same essay got passed to the games program. Like, I'm sure I wanted to do TV. So I looked like such a jackass. But I, you know, anyone like running a program knows that kids don't know what they want. So they let me in. Tracy Fullerton and Scott Fisher, who were running that program, let me in. That's the beginning of games for me.
When did you realize that games were a viable industry?
I mean, I knew it was a viable industry, but I didn't consider it as a job until... Well, I didn't consider it as a job when I was, like, a kid because I didn't think it was a job.
Yeah.
And then as I was finishing college, I didn't think it was viable because I just... I had a lot of financial pressures and life pressures happening, and there was just nothing in New York. So it just felt not viable. But then when I went to film school, I didn't choose the game program because, honestly, it felt a little too... It felt like from their materials and stuff, it looked too art-focused and not at all, like, production and, like, it didn't look like a program where I could come in and then have a career where I'd get paid for my work. And I was old enough at that point, like, not that old, but, like, mid-20s, that I was like, if I'm going to move across the country and go to film school and pay for that, I want to know that there's a career path here. So it wasn't until I got to the film school and met everyone at the game program and realized, oh, I can actually roll this, I think, into a real job in the industry and real... Like, I can sell games if I make them.
That's interesting. That was actually kind of my experience, but I never took that final leap into the game program. I basically hung out in their hall and used their Cintiqs and their Unreal licenses, but never jumped into their program. Because I had the same kind of trepidation. It was very art-focused, very much... It was actually too production-focused, as in... content production focused, and I wanted to keep that big picture scope that I was allowed to have in this comic book study, because, you know, you can make comic books by yourself, whereas making games by yourself is possible but takes a lot longer and a lot more skills, whereas if you can write and draw, you're pretty much set for comics. But it's interesting because I also, with comics, I often start comic projects and they become game projects, they become toy and games. Because I do feel that draw for interactivity.
It's funny, I have a game project that I baked back down into a comic project, although I've never really started it as a comic project, but I put it on the shelf and I was like, this will only be reborn as a comic. This will no longer be a video game.
What made you take the game part out of it?
I feel like when I start a game project, like, you know, it's whenever you start a game, it's always some combination or on a sliding scale between... Is this, am I starting with a game system or am I starting with a concept or a story, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that game in particular, that was the Moonlighters, which Max mentioned, that, like, was my master's school thesis and was a game I worked on for a few years and almost crowdfunded. It was the game I put down to join Hyperlight. The reason that I turned that into a comic, I won't get too deep into the project backstory, is that because it was always driven by this concept that I wanted to recreate the mechanisms of a heist movie into a game. But really, it was about this story. It was about the story of fear of obsolescence and entertainers in the late 50s and what happened to them when television became really dominant and like teen culture became a thing in the early 60s and sort of made a lot of people very suddenly a lot less important than they were in the public eye. And I found that really fascinating and had this whole story. And then the story got really developed, but the game never really clicked. Like, I never really found a game that I thought was even worth it. So it's just at a point where it's like I love this story and I'm not super jazzed about the game. So I'd be starting from scratch on the mechanics and might as well just take that opportunity to work on a comic.
Yeah, comics are always they're a different kind of undertaking because you can collaborate on comics, but I find it harder to do so than on games. I feel like with games, everyone has a role, or it's easy to find people who have roles, whereas comics, you meet a lot of people who are cross-discipline and just collaborating on illustration. You basically are collaborating on illustration, and it's really hard. Like, you know, it's not like you can share a comic page over Perforce. You kind of have to, you know, get your pencils in, get your story in, and then send it to an inker. There's no kind of back and forth the way that games have that I would miss, or I do miss when I do try to collaborate on comics.
It's a lot less people to deal with, though.
It is. I mean, it's, well, as a younger Jolie saw that as a boon, but the more I work in game companies and, you know, here I am now in AAA, I actually kind of like having a lot of people in the room.
Jolie, when you were at Telltale, what was the process like on your end?
So it changed a lot depending on where I was. When I started, I was very much on the receiving end of design. So I would execute designs that I got, which meant usually a script and some really loose interactivity prompts. And then I implemented that in the levels. Being a cinematic artist at Telltale is kind of like making machinima. you get a bunch of voice lines and animations and characters and sets, and you just build them and make them happen. But then by the time I left Telltale, I was a designer, so it was the other way around, where I was sitting in we actually had writer's rooms, and we would sit in a room with a writer or a group of writers and a group of designers and hash out these scenes. Usually looking at a story always came first. And so we would look at the story and figure out where interaction kind of worked. And obviously Telltale has a very specific tool set and a very specific style of gameplay, so it was more taking our existing tools, sometimes modifying them to fit better, but usually, you know, taking the tried and true tools that we had and letting them tell the story. And then so it was kind of doing that and then dictating that sort of, I say dictating today, it's unfair, collaborating with the cinematic folks and the artists and other people in the production line on how to make that happen.
Were you doing storyboarding work here too?
We never did storyboarding at Telltale, which is such a shame, because we just didn't have enough designers who could, and Telltale was getting so large, they didn't really have room for kind of pet production styles. Like, they really were trying to unify how every episode was made and how every game was made, and it was too time consuming and too much to worry about if people were kind of having their own processes. That's much different at Ubisoft, where it's kind of just become part of, we're a small enough team, it just kind of became my part of the job as this kind of storyboarding person. But it's mostly verbal. They have a tool that's unlike any tool I've ever seen in other studio, which really lets it actually, it's very easy to kind of create a script that is digestible by many different departments. So it works that way.
It's funny how that happens, where a tool becomes usable enough that it overtakes like other early techniques in sketching out a scene or in a game. Like, that happened with Hyperlight, where I was used to building levels on pen and paper, like just like iterating through or doing something in Illustrator or something that was faster than actually building an engine. And then we built our own engine, or we built our own editor, and it got so good that it was like, well, like, we made it so you could literally play while you're editing. So it's like, well, why would I not just build in the tool?
Right. Yeah. And that was like what we were always kind of, what production would always come back and say, why don't you just use other assets? And we're like, yeah, I guess so.
Did you stop doing pencil and paper level design then? Or did you use the...
I would do like, so I didn't do level design for long on Hyperlight. I did it for like a few months when we were doing our preview, and then Casey Hunt became our lead level designer and did the bulk of it for a good while. But when I was doing them, I was usually, all I was doing on paper was like sketching ideas. Like, okay, this is what this scenario is about. This is like the gimmick or something. But I wasn't sketching out like the scripting or the real arrangement of the space. It was just kind of very rough thumbnails.
Okay. And just to backtrack a bit, so you went to USC for writing. What was your background with writing before then?
Before then, my background with writing was predominantly invisible. Like, a lot of my actual writing, I'm one of those people where, like, I'm, like, historically, I'm much more of a narrative, like, if you're trying to use game terminology, I'm, like, much more of a narrative and storytelling design person than I am a word-writing person. So whenever I've written words historically, they're, like, screenplays that I've buried or TV scripts that I've buried because, like, what do you do with a screenplay if you're not going to, like, push it forward? Like, I guess you have people read it, but...
Right, example?
Yeah, yeah.
Were these TV scripts pilots, or are they... like specs of existing shows?
I did a lot of pilots because I really like pilots. Like, I went through a course of time where I was really obsessed with pilots specifically, just because I find it like a very particular craft to like kick off an entire show, let alone an entire season, introduce an entire cast if you're doing like a big ensemble show, like in 22 minutes or 44 minutes, you know?
And then to... moving to Hyperlight. So what led to the decision to not have any text in Hyperlight?
You know, it happened really quickly. Like, it happened, I mean, it sort of happened before the Kickstarter with Alex and Beau, but I remember the conversation during the Kickstarter. We all went out to Alex's uncle had a house, so we went out there and sat around a table and, like, talked through some of the pillars of the game and, like, what it was going to be now that we knew we were making it. And that was kind of something that it already was like, are we going to have words in this game? And everybody was like based on what the game has already and just the work that, like, Alex and Casey, or two of the original four, and Alex, who started the project, like, did a short film together that was animated. I think they only got to animatic, but, like, that was no words, and we'd all seen it and liked it, and we were like, let's just do this. Let's do no words, like... I think, you know, it was like a question of, can we pull this off? And the art team felt like, yeah, we can do enough visually that we can pull this off. And we felt like, yeah, this is an interesting constraint, so let's just go for it. Fuck it.
What did that give you?
What did it give us? A tone, you know? Like, it gave us a style and an approach and a feeling. Like, once you start having characters talk, it changes the pace of the game, but it also changes, like, the feeling of that world. And there was something to... Hyperlight generally being a game that doesn't really talk to you, like, not just in dialogue, but in menus and in its design, it's very much like, here I am, come figure me out. So it kind of synchronized with I think, the gameplay and every component.
Was there ever a point when you wanted to put dialogue in the game, or people on the team wanted to put dialogue in the game, or there were, like, second thoughts about not having any dialogue or text?
No. We were kind of into it from the beginning. And fortunately, we got... Sean Ward, who was our animator, who was an SCAD student, actually, from Georgia, who made a fan animation and posted it somewhere, and it got to us, and Alex was like, you're hired! And he was like, cool, I'm moving to LA. And we were like, great! And we were very fortunate that we did that, because that contributed a lot to our ability to storytell. But we never really pulled back into dialogue. I was tempted to, but it never. There was never a reason to. I just, I like words a lot, so... It was a cool exercise for me to, like, pull away from words.
Was there ever a worry about the audience not being able to understand the story that you're providing?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think that... I don't know. The story as we sketched it out was never intricate. And if you walk through the details of the story of Hyperlight, like, there aren't a lot of beats to it. I mean, there are, but the beats are all so... They're very simple ideas, and the cast is very simple. Like, there aren't a lot of characters that we really get into. There's... two, maybe three, depending on what you count as a character. So there just wasn't a lot of intricacy to go through. And it just kind of worked with the scope and the aspirations for the details of the plot and the story. It was never a plot heavy. There were times where the game was more plot heavy and we did pull back. Like, there were going to be more detailed interactions with people in the game.
What does that mean?
Like, so if you play the game now, like, this is not really a spoiler. There's, like, the central city, and that's where most of the NPCs are. And you find other characters throughout the world who are, you know, not there to be murdered. But by and large, there aren't, like, you don't discover, like, new cities or anything really big of substance. There was a time where that was not the case, and we were considering doing towns. RPG towns are, like, my favorite thing in the world, so we were dabbling with that, but that was a harder thing to pull off. Like, the let's tell so many different stories in detail. And those got boiled down into little, like, micro stories that do get told when you go into the regions, but they're very small. Like, they're told in a handful of panels, story panels.
How far along did you get with the towns?
Like a week of concept.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did the story, overall story, change at all during development?
Yeah. I mean, the story of the Drifter never really changed. That was kind of the thing that was set in stone, because, like, Alex knew how he wanted the story to start and end, and much of the journey was dictated pretty well. But certainly the stories of each region, like, I don't want to say necessarily the environmental stories, but, like, the stories of each region of the world and their history definitely developed over time. They had themes that didn't change at a certain point, but the details of, like, what exact story we were telling changed, especially as we focused down and down, because there were times where, like, the East had two different stories that were kind of going on at the same time, and we had to, like, just cut and cut and cut.
So when you guys had those pillars that you talked about, did you really stick to those for most of production?
Good question. I think so. I haven't... The funny thing is, like, it wasn't... I've been on projects where we actually set, like, these are the five guiding pillars of this video game, and we're going to stick to them. And any decision in which we disagree, we will look to the pillars as our guiding light.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really valuable tool at a certain team size and a certain context. But in this case, the pillars were just kind of, like, very inherent values that we had from the beginning, which is, like a deep, deep attention to detail, where, like, if we didn't have the ability to put, like, an obsessive amount of love and detail into, like, any element, it usually got cut.
Mm.
Obviously, like, the no words was a strong pillar. But yeah, like, we didn't have, I don't know. Do you have pillars on your current game?
We do. They were actually, I asked because I found that, especially at Telltale, we would create a game, and maybe it was because we were so quickly putting a game into the engine and not doing a lot of pre-visualization work, that we often would get a first pass milestone and end up reevaluating the whole story. Like, we would get it into the engine and we would start playing it and it wouldn't work. And that seemed to be tried and true on every single episode. I think I've worked on, like, 20 plus episodes of Telltale games, and almost everyone goes through this kind of upheaval and reevaluation. And we do use our pillars. We had season pillars there, and that was where we kind of looked. But yeah, it was very rare when we kind of from the outset made a story that worked narratively, but then also worked on an interactive level. But I suppose then you have more of a, I mean, Hyperlight's definitely more of a gameplay focused game.
It's pretty video gamey.
Yeah,
and most of the, like, I mean, I was. My focus was always on the Drifter's story. Like, that's what I cared most about, was making sure that character arc came through. Whereas there were team members who put, you know, a lot more work and energy and like, deep, deep world building and lore into the environments and the worlds and the story of the worlds.
I had an interesting conversation with my lead designer the other day about how the games that studios create differ based on what department heads the studio. So we know that, like, we were talking about the different studios. Like, obviously, I've only been at Telltale and Ubisoft, but we were talking about other studios and how the game shook out and kind of looked at them from who was driving it. So, like, you know, you have a place like Mojang, which is mostly engineers, and it's an engineering-driven studio. And you have Telltale, that's a very narrative-driven studio. My lead was at Insomniac, and he was like, actually, animators drove Ratchet and Clank. And you see that. Yeah. Like, would you say, like Heart Machine's kind of a, like a visual storytelling driven studio?
I mean, it's so small, you know? Like, the thing that I love about that game is that, like, the four or five of us that were there full-time every day, all day for the whole project, like, had such different focuses,
mm-hmm.
foci, that, that's not a word, that it sorted out a lot of priorities and who was working on what, and those were sort of like the points of a star, so to speak. Like, so I don't think that that was ever overwhelmed. You know, I mean, I think we knew that a lot of the storytelling was going to come down to, like, just the art team.
Mm-hmm.
Even more so than animation, because animation is so expensive. But I don't know. I mean, like, the first year of production was all about game feel and combat mechanics and how to make the character feel according to what that character is supposed to be like, you know, which is, like, very little storytelling. But what I was getting at earlier is that since you're largely just traveling through this world as a character and it is very video gamey, that, like, most of the Drifter's journey is told through just, like, the feel of the combat and the emergent story, so to speak, that you go through in the struggles that you face.
That's cool. I don't think a lot of companies or game teams actually do that pass. Like, I always try to talk about, when I do talks to, like, students, I usually break design down into systems, levels, and narratives, and that usually covers most bases, I feel.
Yeah.
And I try to connect them all and say, like, oh, okay, here's a narrative game where narrative is the main gameplay, and then here's a game where levels serve the narrative. And then I get to a game where the systems drive the narrative, and my first example is always Street Fighter, for that same reason, of every character in Street Fighter has a very specific game feel that tells a story of what they study, like what martial art they use. And it's usually actually pretty clear, especially in the older games when they were extremely divergent in their playstyles, and you have games like Guilty Gear and like BlazBlue and stuff like that where they're extremely divergent to the point where you are kind of surprised you're playing the same fighting game with some characters. But it does tell kind of the story just through feel of how this character is.
Well, I think parody is super important no matter what, right? Like,
right.
One of my favorite games, at least lately, is Catherine, which is a game that's made by the Persona team.
Mm-hmm.
And on first glance, the mechanic is like a huge departure from the story, because it's like Vincent is having these dreams where he's climbing these block puzzles. Like, on paper, it sounds ludicrous, and a lot of people bounce out of the game because it's like, oh, a story about relationships, but it's a block puzzle. And you're like, oh, that sounds completely disparate. Fuck that game. But but in truth, like, can I curse on this podcast?
Yeah.
Doing it already.
It's explicit.
Cool. Because the way they balance those levels and the way it always feels is that, like, Vincent is barely keeping his shit together in the story, and you're just barely staying ahead of death, which is, like, chasing you through those block puzzles, because there's kind of, like, a, not a time limit, but, like, a move limit to how much you can be moving before you fall to your death.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, that plays into the animation, and he's, like, climbing these blocks that are designed to be about his height, so he just looks like he's really, there's a lot of effort in it. And there's a lot of, like, mechanics that make him slide or stumble or otherwise look like he just, like, does not have it together. And, I mean, maybe that's presentation, but I think, like, mechanically, it's like, okay, he's trying to stay, you know, afloat. It's like he's kind of drowning, and he's just keeping his chin above the water.
Yeah, that's great. I love that, like, when they can get that. I love creating metaphors in gameplay.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the way that, like, Tetris is one of my favorite games, just because it is this kind of, like, you know, futility in building a wall kind of thing that you get.
Yeah. No, metaphor is a great way to put it, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Jolie, you gave a talk at GDC about puzzle design.
I did.
So were puzzles more part of your work at Telltale or at Square?
You mean Ubisoft?
Ubisoft, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, both. At Telltale, that was, like, kind of actually my avenue into design from the cinematics team, because I was one of the cinematic artists who did enjoy scripting and did enjoy, like, kind of design. I felt like a lot of people on that team are really hardcore film people. Like, they love movies. Like, it was such a great studio to, like, just sit down and talk about movies with people and storytelling. but I was one of the only ones who really kind of took the puzzle assignments by the horns and said, yes, I'm going to make this crazy interactive sequence, and that's going to happen. And that's kind of how I jumped my way into design, just making prototyping and creating strange sequences. Like, there's actually a sequence in Walking Dead 400 Days where you're in a cornfield. And that was just me and a programmer slapping assets into the game, into the engine, and making it something. And it shipped, which is cool. It shipped my code, which is horrifying, but it's in there.
So what's your design process for puzzles?
Throwing it. It's a lot of it's throwing it in there. Like, and again, the Telltale Engine let us really just chuck stuff into the engine and try it out, which was super great for puzzles. I actually try not to dawdle too long in paper design when it comes to puzzles, because it does come down to kind of feeling it. There's a lot of pre-checks you can make, and I talk about that a little bit in the GDC talk, just about kind of some checkboxes you can find, like, does the player understand what's going on? Have you prepared the player for this puzzle? Does the puzzle have a through line? But yeah, the best remedy is always kind of getting in there, playing it, putting it in other people's hands, watching them play it.
So when you want to put that puzzle in 400 days, what made you want to put a puzzle there specifically?
So 400 days was cool because it was, I think it was 5 vignettes, and we wanted each of them to feel very different. So the design team was kind of just brainstorming, okay, what are the like main, because we had such little time. It was basically the size of a Telltale episode, but we had 5 stories to tell instead of 1. So they were kind of trying to find basically these mini games that would all be very different and all make every story change and evoke the feeling, whatever the core feeling was to that particular snippet of the episode. We wanted to evoke that feeling with a mini game of some sort. And so with this one, we wanted to really feel fear and anxiety. It was about a woman who was, basically you're playing a woman who's getting chased by just like some guys who think, I think they assume you've stolen their supplies, or that you're, you know, some warring faction in a zombie apocalypse land, as they do. So you assume you're being chased by these people with flashlights, and then at the end you emerge and attack who you think is an attacker, but it ends up being someone who was in your party, who's a part of your little survivor group. So we wanted this kind of arc of being scared to the point where you're ready to just kind of lash out at anything that comes at you and destroy them. So the minigame we made up was this kind of cornfield, and we wanted this like narrative arc of people catching up to you, but we never wanted them to actually catch up to you. So we made the player feel like they were always on the verge of getting caught by the enemies, which were just kind of flashlights. Like, they were just flashlight cones, actually, just like light cones. But from the cornfield, all you can see was that, and that was enough to make the player feel like there was somebody there. And we tuned it so that we made sure the player had free movement and was able to go wherever they wanted, but always kind of had an escalating number of close encounters with these flashlights before they emerged into the clearing, where we had them do the final blow to what they thought was an enemy and ended up being their friend. So that was a really long-winded way of saying we needed the gameplay there to make you feel something.
Does that happen a lot? Or did that happen a lot there, where people have to check themselves and make sure that there's more gameplay in the Telltale games and not just pure story?
I think 400 Days... somehow 400 Days got out the door with a lot of gameplay in it. It's really interesting, and I think
more than usual.
Yeah, and I think the design team was very proud of that project, and I was very proud of that project as well, because we did get to do a lot of that stuff. It just kind of hit at the right time. We had time to do that kind of thing. We had time to prototype and time to play around. We had a dedicated team to do so and the right team to do so, and it just happened. It was definitely kind of like a unique project. It was interesting to have a kind of a one shot. It was probably the only one shot I think Telltale's actually ever made, come to think of it.
When you're iterating on puzzles, would you say, like, on average, are you iterating a lot, or do you usually get it right in the first couple tries?
Oh, it's iterating. There's a quote by Mark Rosewater, who's the lead designer on Magic: The Gathering, And he always says, design is basically just a lot of redesign, is the gist of the quote. And that's so true. And that's why I like to get stuff in as fast as possible and get it playable, because a game isn't a game until it's a game, until it's playable. You can talk about it on a whiteboard all you want, but it needs to be a game that you can play and talk about. So yeah, it's a lot of, I would say it's very rare that you just nail a puzzle unless you're at that point in a puzzle game where you're just kind of making filler puzzles and you know exactly how your mechanics work and you can predict how two mechanics or more are going to interact with each other and how the player will perceive them, then yeah, it gets a little easier and you can probably knock them out without too much iteration. But especially when you're creating those core puzzles and those, you know, that first batch of your mechanics really getting tested together, yeah, you're changing a lot.
Have you ever knocked it out like on the first try?
No.
Just curious.
No.
There was some Kickstarter that went up during our production for Hyperlight that, like, it was a bunch of, like, students who were coming out of some school, some game school, and they were like, you know, what most games do wrong is that they rush into production, and, like, we're going to take a better approach, a more efficient approach, where we just get it right the first time.
Wow.
I was like, wow, this is so, like, throwing so much shade and, like, so...
There was, like, everyone stay back. Let's watch them burn.
Yeah, exactly.
Why like, didn't I think of that?
Please
that's
fund
what
this.
We've been missing.
Oh, we should just do it right.
Good point, guys. I don't remember what happened in that project.
Which I don't think anyone does.
Yeah.
For both of you, what do you think of modern puzzle design?
I like it when it I feel like we're on this, like, precipice of narrative-driven... I mean, so there's definitely still just things like The Witness that are mechanics-based. You know, your kind of classic... Here's a mechanic, it's being progressed, it's being combined with other mechanics, standard sort of thing, like the evolution of Portal, if you will. And those, I think, are good. They're on trajectory. I think we know what needs to happen with those. The mechanics become better, the puzzles become smoother, the kind of tutorialization becomes more accessible as the gaming demographic gets bigger. But I think we're very much still lacking in the more narrative puzzle stuff. I don't think we really have evolved. I feel like we kind of hit a wall with adventure games where, you know, you try to get narrative moments, but if you try to inject too much narrative, you're always gonna lose some people. You know, everyone perceives ideas and stories in a different way. So those kinds of puzzles especially are really hard to playtest and sometimes are, in my opinion, like, actually impossible to just make accessible to an entire, if you want a very wide demographic, it can just get to a point where you need to tell, at least have a failsafe where someone can be told what the answer is, because you just don't know how a player is going to perceive it, especially if they're from extremely different demographics, like age being a big one, location, culture is huge. We actually had a really interesting problem on Wolf Among Us, where we had a dialogue choice where you're sitting at a bar with a guy who you perceive as a criminal, or who your main character you're playing as, Bigby, perceives as a criminal. And one of the options was glass him. And the writer intended it to be to hit him over the head with your glass.
Mm.
Which is apparently, he's not Australian, but apparently it's an Australian parlance sort of thing. But many people I talked to released around PAX, and I had so many people come up to us at PAX and say, "I thought I was going to cheers him. I thought we were going to cheers." and then suddenly we were fighting. So I don't know if I don't have a solution to that problem yet, but it's definitely a more interesting frontier in my opinion, because there is so much to problem solve there. Those more narrative interpretation puzzles.
What sort of narrative stuff do you want?
Good narrative? I guess, I mean, that's where emergent narrative comes in, right? Like, and that's actually, yeah. I think, the strength in Hyperlight and games like that kind of have minimal spoken narrative or textual narrative, in that you allow more room for the player to interpret, and so they never feel like they're wrong. You never specifically read something and feel and get an idea a certain way and then are told, no, that wasn't cheers him, that was smack him over the head with a glass. You kind of, the feedback is a lot more subtle.
Mm. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's. I mean, I guess that's fair about Hyperlite. It's funny because I'm such a defender of words. Like, I actually do love words, and by no means was Hyperlite a statement against words. You know, it wasn't like, this is what a game storytelling should be.
You don't need them.
Yeah, fuck them.
Every game should be the witness.
Exactly.
Witness has words.
Mm. No, it sure does. Well, yeah. Yeah.
Well, we don't talk about this.
Moving on. We've had a lot of shade throughout The Witness on this podcast.
Oh, no. To be fair, I love The Witness. I love that game. It's just a game I would never have the capacity to make or the patience to make.
But when I think of like the narrative puzzles I want is more around, there's going to be some breakthrough in AI where not like, because AI is getting better with terms of like the physical actions that NPCs can do and stuff like that, but not, we haven't gotten to a point where like AI has influenced like character traits. So like, I like to have a puzzle around, I need to convince this person to do something and try to talk them into or out of something. I want a political thriller video game really badly. I want it all being dialogue based.
Yeah, I think the limit to that right now, I feel like, is because it's always going to be written by somebody.
Yeah.
Somebody has their perfect interpretation of that or the way they would solve the problem. It's really tough as a designer, I think, to subvert that and have a more global view. Like,
well, to me, yeah, I mean, to me, like, a more complex AI in a, is tantamount to, like, the conversation I'd have with people, like, years ago. I'd have friends with, conversation with friends from, like, high school, and they'd be like, oh, I love Grand Theft Auto. Like, when do you think there's going to be a game where I can do anything?
Right.
And I'm like, that's not actually
It's called
game.
Everything. It's made by David O'Reilly. It's coming out next year.
I have played Everything, and it's lovely. But even Everything is not everything. You know, like, once it's Everything, it's not anything. It's not it's not a game anymore. It's a world. And same with, like, that is, like, you could do that, but it would never be, like, the evolution of all game puzzles, because it wouldn't be a puzzle anymore. Like, the way I was taught, so A, I don't know shit about puzzles. Like, I'm not a puzzle designer. I'm more of, like, a systems or narrative designer. And to me, I was taught, like, a puzzle is effectively, like, a system with a solution, or maybe a couple solutions, but it's, that's just the way I've always interpreted puzzles. And if you get a complex AI, like, there is no longer a solution, because if it's thinking and if it's, like, really elaborate, that's not actually what you want players to be able to kind of, like, solve it. And you can't really solve a real conversation. You can get cooler narrative, and you get, like, cooler, like, dialogue, or maybe not cooler, but you can get more unexpected dialogue, or a community that evolves around, like, getting different responses out of the AI. But I mean, you guys know, like, you're writers, it's like, whenever someone's like, is there going to be a game that can write itself? You're like, why would you want that?
Probably, but you're still going to want someone to help create your, like, custom content for it, because it won't be exactly like...
Right.
There needs to be a curation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, at some form.
And that's it. Like, it's, you kind of lose that game as a lens into the creator, which I think is a cool part of games, is at least... this is a window into how someone interprets the world. It's not the real world, but, you know, it's art in that way. It's an interpretation of it. It's a lens through which to look at how people talk to each other and have conversations.
I love that.
Yeah.
Like, the more discreet a design choice is, the more it is a conversation between the designer and the players, even if that's not totally how they think about it. But, you know, like, maybe I think about this more because I am a game designer, but, like, I know in Hyperlite there are definitely battles where we do a second wave, and I'm sure the response for people is like, oh, fuck you guys. Like, and we're like, yep, this is what we're doing right now.
Mm-hmm. I've read those comments.
Yeah.
Yep. But I've made those comments sometimes.
But it's not, it's a it's a fuck you and like a, oh, you dog, like, you bastard. It's not necessarily out of, like, rejection of the choice. It's out of, like, it's a conversation, and it's like, oh, we got you. We got you with that one.
Mm-hmm.
So what game or games have you had the most intimate conversations with the developers?
Ooh.
The Witness is one, actually.
Yeah.
Witness feels like Jonathan Blow telling me how video games are made. It was actually torture working on that GDC talk about puzzles while that game was out. Like I basically started it after going to GDC China, which was in October, and you know GDC Prime is in March, and between then The Witness came out, and I basically rewrote the talk because I felt like I had such a conversation with Jonathan Blow without ever meeting him.
Oh yeah, like and every step forward in that game is like, oh, you think you understand it? What if I tell you this? And you mm-hmm. go, whoa, John Blow, you blah. Like when my friend Tyler and I were playing it, and we would like whenever we would beat a puzzle or beat a series of puzzles, we would like our meme was like Jonathan Blow just broke another pencil, like in frustration. Like I felt I like I was in dialogue with him.
And maybe this is because we're designers and that we are aware of like kind of the video game world. But when I played that game, I just pictured him as this villain. And I was trying to get through his dungeon, like, just, like, climbing his castle and trying to get to his, like, keep where I could finally defeat him and say that I won his game.
And get to the top, and it's a hologram.
Yeah, or it's a video of some British guy talking to me.
John Blow's all like, would you kindly solve this puzzle?
So it's both your answers to The Witness?
We can make another answer.
I mean, are there any, like, games that are built by bigger developers, studios, or is it mostly smaller ones?
Well, that's interesting too, because when you get larger studios, you start feeling it's more of a like collective message from a group of people. Like Saints Row actually kind of has that effect on me. Like I can really, after meeting a few people like who I know work at that studio or aspire to work at that studio, it feels like they definitely have something to say about games being goofy and not taking things too seriously. And I, despite the like massive size of those teams, that comes through, and maybe that's Pillars, maybe that's just their creatives having a unified vision, but at least feels unified.
That's a great example. Like the mechanic by which you can dive into a car instead of opening the door by running and then pushing the button. It feels like it's a response video on YouTube posted to like every GTA Mafia driver game you've ever played, which is like, I'm tired of watching this animation. I just want to be in the fucking car.
Right.
Like, I know it's just 3 seconds. You know, just like the instant respawn in Super Meat Boy. Like, it's just a design decision. It's not it's not really like a narrative statement, but it is a conversation about like, yeah, we all know that this is frustrating, and so we're going to do this absurd thing that doesn't even, like, if you watched it frame by frame, I'm sure it wouldn't make sense. I have no idea what happens to the body when you dive through the windshield. You know, I'm sure it's just this insta snap, but you know, it's like, we're just going to give you this.
Mm-hmm. I think that comes from a culture, a company culture that's just super cohesive. Yeah, despite the size. Granted, I haven't met all of that studio, but I can see that happening when a studio is just kind of all has a very similar outlook on games.
Teddy, you gave a Lost Levels talk a while back about giving the player control when they're not expecting it and letting them influence a game's systems and stories. What were the experiments you did with this, and what did you learn?
Ooh, deep cuts.
My deepest cut is looking at your thesis.
Yes. Oh, you didn't read it, did you?
I read part of it.
Okay. We had to write a thesis paper for our MFA in interactive media because of the details of that department. But what I was talking about in that talk, which was a short 5-minute talk, was like a boiling down of, I'm going to get real academic for a minute, I'm sorry, capital N, capital D narrative design. So a boiling down of an idea of a way to let players interact with a story. And so I did sort of like a survey and breakdown of different ways by which that you do this. I'm sure Julie can probably talk circles around me about some of this topic. But the particular approach I was taking was, what can we do in the sphere of having the game story change in big or small ways in response to what you do during the game that is not dialogue choice, that is like in a game where it is not meant to be that sort of game, where it's not like the primary mechanic is choosing dialogue, but instead the primary mechanic is running and jumping, or like a game like GTA where like your mechanics are just kind of the actions that your character is taking. Like, what can we do? Where can we eke out interaction in a way that makes the story or the game feel like it's listening to you? So I like called it, and again, this is like going to get real heady, but I called it narrative listening for that reason. And God, where do I even go? What's the first question here? Like,
well, I was going to ask about narrative listening later because that's from your thesis. So have you developed this at all since that your thesis, and have any additional thoughts about its benefits or weaknesses?
The cool thing I liked about this is that it's pretty micro. It's pretty like instance by instance. And most of the situations that I found in existing games that inspired me thinking about this are not pervasive. Like, it's not a system designed to be like, hey, build a game around narrative listening. It's designed to be like a, let's do this thing. And you've probably done this in Telltale games, surely. But like the concept of like having something that you do, like what object you pick up, like with the alternate mechanics in Telltale games, like what object you pick up, which door you go into, things like that.
I think the challenge. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
I mean, I would love to talk about that. Like the trick there is like, well, how do you have the game respond in a way that makes the player feel responsible, but you can't really be punitive. You can't punish them because a lot of those choices are made in the dark or made without thinking that it's going to have that impact. And like the desire that I was trying to, the thing I was trying to push forward with is like, I don't want to design an entire game around this, but I want to occasionally find moments to do it because it makes it feel very like real. It's like, yes, this happened because of what I did, but I couldn't really have known that that's what was going to happen, but I'm still like integrated into the decision making of these characters. I don't know if that makes any sense.
No, yeah. I think the challenge with that kind of gameplay is when you get that subtle, it is difficult for the player to even understand that the game was listening. And that's the real tough balance. And I think that's why a lot of games, especially Telltale games, have gotten, I don't want to say heavy-handed, but they've gotten very explicit. And you have made a choice and it resulted in this. And you see that, you know, in Mass Effect, you see that in Fallout 4. It's very explicit, and I think it's honestly a lot because it is it's a lot of work to make choices, and it's you know, you're always duplicating or quadrupling content when you add choices in a game, and it is a bummer when the player doesn't even perceive something like that.
Well, like what I liked about it is that I think the goal is kind of what I think Telltale games do so well, or at least the ones that I've experienced like the most thoroughly, like most of the Walking Dead series, is that you do that thing where there are times where it is more explicitly like, oh, your action had this effect. And so the game, like, it feels like a lot of the experience is banking on the fact, it's tricking me into thinking that more of my decisions have an impact than they do. Because like you're saying, it is expensive to branch your story. It's expensive to let the player have a real significant impact on the story. So the more you can kind of just make them feel like the game is paying attention, the better, even if the game's not always paying attention. And then of course you have to look out for pitfalls of them expecting to have an impact and not, but like, you know, when you tell it, like when you tell them like, oh, a character will remember this.
That was our bread and butter on Walking Dead. And I think Walking Dead was actually our best execution of it. I think later Telltale games, you actually see the abuse of that. If you play Game of Thrones, you see it kind of abused to the point where you don't believe it anymore.
Yeah.
Whereas Walking Dead Walking Dead had the advantage of being the first Telltale game to do it. I think a lot of the Telltale fans who play, you know, all the games became very privy to it very quickly. But I think the first Telltale game you play, no matter what it is, you do experience that mechanic, and it does make you think, oh, it's listening to me, even when it's totally not.
Well, that was like the thing I always looked back to as my favorite is in Chrono Trigger. Do you know like the courtroom scene?
Oh, yes. Yeah. That, right. Yeah.
Oh, it's so good.
But it's so pulled off because I do understand exactly what I did, even though I didn't know I was making those decisions in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah, that was like in the paper that I wrote or whatever, like in the defense I gave so they'd give me a degree. That was like a pivotal part of what I found to be important with like on my end, which is just like you have to set up some way to listen to what they're doing, and then you have to call it back clearly. And if you don't call it back clearly, then like you're missing the whole point. That's your opportunity to make that sort of little tickle in their brain of like, oh, like the game's paying attention. Mm-hmm. So for context, in Chrono Trigger, there's this scene where you get arrested and you're brought to trial, and a number of like NPCs come and bear witness to your character as character witnesses. And maybe not all of them, but many of them will call back to actions that you've taken as a player that were completely insignificant. So like there's a part where Chrono bumps into the lead girl in the story whose name I'm forgetting. But you bump into her and she falls down, and she also drops her pendant, and you have to basically click on both. And so you like help her up and you pick it up for her, and somebody judges you based on which one you go to first. Like, do you help her up or do you grab the necklace first? And it's sort of like a subtle Paragon Renegade thing. It's a subtle like, oh, you like care more about the gold or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's what's funny is that in that context, that's so arbitrary, but that's exactly how you're supposed to feel, because you're like, this motherfucker doesn't know anything about me. Mm-hmm. And like, they're being so judgy on me, and they just find a way to like contextualize that particular thing in a way that makes it like that gives it a lot of whimsy and like is really entertaining. And also the game doesn't really punish you for that. Like, you don't get completely screwed over for the rest of the game or something. Mm-hmm. because that happened. It's just a moment where the game says, hey, we're kind of listening. And they don't really follow up with that ever again. But that's what I think is the opportunity there in any game, is like, it's relatively cheap to set up like one particular event like that and then have that influence, have like two or three, one variable even like influence the story. But you get so much of a memorable experience.
Yeah, and your note about like it not being punitive is really important too, because it's so tempting. I think the like evil D&D dungeon master in all of us, you know, wants like kind of kill the like, oh, you chose the bad thing and now you're gonna pay for it. Like that retribution that kind of is so, you know, pervasive through stories.
Mm-hmm.
Good. We had that in, like, there were times in Walking Dead where we had to really step back and go, are we judging somebody for their decisions? Because a big part of dialogue-based games that I really like is that you are role-playing, and a player is making a choice, or ideally the player is making a choice that they truly believe in, and they have an option that they can stand behind, they have their own reasonings too. And the game, when you have the game kind of put its own spin on those choices, or if you have the game judge for it, it takes that freedom away a little bit. Whereas when you kind of just let things happen and let the story happen and keep the player's context and reasons in that and on them, it feels like a more personal experience.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think that's really well put. An awesome notable exception, I'm going to keep going back to this because it's like my favorite, Catherine.
Uh-huh.
Has a Paragon Renegade system whereby, like, between levels, you answer one moral question related to dating. And what's awesome is that the axis on which they judge you, because they do judge you, right? You answer blind, and you don't know whether your answer is Paragon or Renegade, and then you see the meter move.
Oh.
And it's so cool, because it's like, the entire morality, this is why I got turned off from the game and then came back to it, is at first I was like, the morals in this game are really fucked up.
Mm-hmm.
And then you realize, like, yeah, they are. And that game wants you to be so mad. Like, there's a question that's like, do you think that you should live with someone before you marry them? And like, the evil choice is yes, you know? And you're like, no, fuck you. Like, I disagree. Like, I disagree with this morality system, but they want that. Like, right. It's so interesting.
That is cool. Actually, I made a Game Jam game a while ago where it's actually a comic book game, and you're on a date, and the object of the game is to make the date go well. And so you play as the boy on the date, and you have speech bubbles. It's presented like a comic book, and you actually change your speech bubbles and try to like elicit a positive response from your partner. And then you play as the girl, and you have to try to, where she got upset or where she didn't respond well, you have to try to change her responses to like make it feel better. And you can play them in any order. You can leave with the boy and leave with the girl, and you can switch back between whenever you want. But it is fun. It was fun writing that because I did get to judge people and their choices, but as like, but role playing. I mean, and I was role playing doing so. I was in character making a judgment. And that's kind of interesting with Catherine too. It feels like I don't know the mechanics of the game very well, but whomever was deciding how Renegade or Paragon certain dating objects was able to kind of build a character, like the game as a character that had its own morals, and it was judging you.
I wanted to backtrack a bit to what you said before, Jolie, about subtlety, the problem with subtlety with like narrative listening. And so Firewatch, after we played the game, there was an interview with Sean Vanneman where he talked about this crazy dialogue system they had rigged up that totally surprised us, because it was all about like, we had the system that was constantly going on in the background and it's analyzing every single action you do in the game and bring up unique dialogue for based on every action you've done in the past. I'm like, what the hell is this? I never felt like I never felt like it was uniquely commenting on my actions in the game. It just felt like, oh, this is a normal game. It has some good writing in it. And I don't know if that's a problem or not, that like I did not realize that they did put a lot of work in this, and that maybe it failed because it didn't feel like it was unique to my experience. Or specific enough, yeah.
It depends on the goal. Oh, sorry, Jelly.
Go ahead. All you.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, my opinion is that it depends on the goal. Like, if the goal is for that system to feel like, to make you aware that you're influencing the dialogue choices, then that's a failure. But if the goal is just to, if it's effectively like a narrative version of adaptive difficulty, where it's just trying to smooth out and match where you want to do, then sure, like let it be invisible.
Yeah, Jake said something really smart. I think it might have been GDC last year, or it might have just been me talking to him, but he said something like, if you build your mechanics first, your narrative is always going to be flexible enough where you can smooth out the jankiness with it. But the other way around will always kind of flop in your face. Because if your narrative is kind of falling apart and you're trying to slam mechanics into it, you're going to get a pretty dissonant experience because you don't have a foundation really on either end. And so I feel like with Firewatch, it was kind of that goal was more, I'm letting the player traverse in what's effectively an open world. Like, obviously, it was more of a hub and spoke or a lock and key Metroidvania kind of world. But still, like, the player had enough freedom that they could move around and had choice of where they move around. I think that system was in place more to make sure that no matter what, your path felt intentional. And I know that game kind of received criticism for being too linear. But in my opinion, it's more, it made you feel that way because it always had an answer to what you were doing.
Yeah. Since you're the first level designer we've had on, Jolie, what's your process like for building a level? Because I am really interested in seeing how designers think about storytelling within when they're building a level.
So I think it actually, again, it depends on your goals. And it kind of comes back to that thing of like, what is driving your game? If your game is being driven by traversal, I think a level, when you sit down with a level, you're going to start grade blocking immediately and you're going to start traversing as fast as you can, getting it in the engine as fast as you can, and just playing it and making sure it feels good. Whereas when you do a narrative level, which is kind of a weird thing, but, you know, my background's a narrative game, so making a narrative level, if we can call it that, or a scene, it is like more like building a scene. So you're kind of finding the story you want to tell, building the space that you need to tell that story. And then I often fill in the gameplay bits later, because usually my story outline already has gameplay bits sort of designated and already kind of, like, for instance, if I need a puzzle somewhere, I will already have narrative context for that puzzle and know what the narrative beat of that puzzle is. So once I figure out my space, I'll look at that space and say, okay, so I know this puzzle has to happen in a warehouse. Let's think of some things in a warehouse for that puzzle to be about and make sure it leads to, let's say, getting out of the warehouse, if that was the goal. So it, in my experience on these more narrative-heavy games, it is very much about a story and knowing exactly what the story is when you're going into that level and what it is when you're leaving that level.
Is pacing in your mind when you're working on them?
Yes, yeah, and that's part of why I storyboard, actually, because that's just my kind of personal language for pacing that I can look at and I can analyze before even putting something in the game. I can look at some storyboards and feel out how fast or how slow something's going to move. The gameplay bits are kind of where it's better to get those in the engine, because puzzles especially, you never really know how long it's going to take somebody to play it unless you put it in their hands. There's always the kind of expected solution and the speed at which you are expecting people to complete the puzzle, but you might want to make that longer or make it shorter based on feedback or based on what it is actually doing in the space once you get it in there for pacing considerations. And that happened a lot in Telltale games. We would kind of fall in love with a really complicated Monkey Island-esque puzzle and then get in the game and say, okay, I had to spend 20 minutes on this puzzle. I do not remember what the story was of this scene. And since this is a story game that's bad, let's pull it back a little bit and make sure that either the puzzle beats are more explicit and moving the story along, or it's shorter and the bridge between the two story beats that bookend the puzzle are closer together and understandable. There's actually a great puzzle in Walking Dead episode one, I think. It's in season one. I think it's episode one or two, and you're stuck in the back of a drugstore. And on paper, it's just a puzzle where you're trying to open this door or you're trying to block off a door from zombies getting in. But it's punctuated by these little beats where you talk to Clementine. And like there's beats where she just kind of asks you about you. She hurts her finger and you have to help her. And they're all in service of the story. So even though it's a pretty long puzzle, it's a long string of interactions, it's punctuated by narrative so much that it still feels like a cohesive story is happening.
Did you say that, so were you storyboarding to help with your level design?
Yeah.
So what do your storyboards look like?
They're like storyboards, it's just
Are you like showing what the player would see?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm really big about cameras. I mean, I started in the industry as a cinematic artist, so I'm always thinking about cameras immediately. So no matter what, I'm always trying to kind of envision exactly what the player is seeing on screen. And actually, Teddy and I talked about this a little bit at RGDC China level design talk about like what you show the player is very important for how they look at the world and how they solve puzzles and how they traverse. I remember you had a really good point about how you do your puzzles in Hyperlight where you kind of have very creative camera movements to make sure that the puzzle isn't kind of spoiled immediately for the player. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, our level design in Hyperlight is very weird, like, to speak specifically to puzzles, I don't know. I think that, yeah, that's like a language, that's more of a conversation again, like, going back to the conversation with design, that, like, when the way we do secrets is we tried to establish a language so that it didn't feel arbitrary, and then we use camera to, like, to give you a little bit of information but not too much, you know, we have like so much control over the camera with the tools we made. But yeah, I don't know, I was gonna ramble about storytelling and level design in Hyperlight, but I don't know where we're going next.
Do it.
All right, let's do this. Swear to God, it's on a tangent.
Otherwise I was gonna transition to environmental storytelling anyway.
There we go. There, okay, go. well yeah, like, so like the, I don't know what's interesting about the level design process at a gray box level, so like, I don't, like, gray box is the term we use a lot, the level designers use, for like the literally, like, your level is staged out in gray boxes, so you don't have art there. It's just like, well, yeah, we need an object here, and maybe you know what it is, maybe you don't, but it's just, that's what you start building with. Like, shape language and path language is, like, really important for the Hyperlight regions, like, not to tell the plot, but to, again, because the Drifter's journey has a lot to do with just the actions and the exploration that you go through, and how that contextualizes what the Drifter is going through with the illness and where the story begins and ends. The regions just are like different types of challenge of exploration and traversal. So like the north is a lot of stairs and climbing and narrow peaks and narrow bridges. You know, this feeling of like really climbing up high and trying to get a feeling of effort out of that. A lot of like dashing from peak to peak. The west is like very mazy, and like the we tried to spend a lot of time. And by we, I mean the primary level design team is Casey Hunt, and then Alex did a lot, and Lisa Brown. But like the goal was to make you feel disoriented is the word we looked for, because we didn't actually want people to be lost, but we wanted them to kind of lose orientation, but and yet like not actually effectively get lost, like not end up backtracking, but just feel like you sort of lose orientation, which is hard in a 2D game because you're always going, it's like, okay, I need to go to the left. I'm in the west. I'm going to keep going left because there's a map that tells me I need to go left. But that ended up making like the paths that we carve in our engine or like, you know, for in our tool were very curvy and windy, and they'd loop back on each other and stuff. And the south was much more like structural. It was much more a big desert, and you go down these long shafts. There's a lot of vertical motion, a lot of riding elevators, and like being in a facility. And the East had a lot to do with like it feeling like a civilization, so a lot of looping back and interconnected roads and tunnels and buildings. But none of that is plot. That's just all like setting a tone and an experience. It's experience design, I guess, is a better way of putting
it. It's feeling. It's kind of that. I think like whenever I go into a level, I ask myself, what is the feeling I want to convey? And it is questions exactly like you just described, Teddy. Like, do I want them to feel lost? Do I want them to feel like they're in a city? And that's kind of usually what I come into. And that's what I get from the story. Like, and again, it's not plot, but it's world. It's the setting.
Yeah. And that informs your like actual plot beats because you understand the pacing, you mm-hmm. know, like, okay, when the player is feeling the most lost, that is when we X. That's when we blank. That's when we like, what do we do to them there? You know, like right. You find the opportunities or you create the opportunities for the beats that you need to hit in your actual plot.
Are there any like, because Hyperlight and what you're describing does have a lot of environmental storytelling. Are there any like do's and don'ts for you when it comes to this? Or at least in general when you're playing other games?
We tried to keep them pretty simple and direct, and what we didn't do a lot of like, here's a 19-part story that you're gonna like uncover over time. Like each region has a sort of understanding that you develop, but any given vignette was kind of like, let's just like make sure they understand what's going on, because as we went through, we realized like how much understanding you lose by not having text. So they were very one-off, and like, especially as we were filling in the holes towards the end of production, we were like, well, we just want more, like there's more opportunities here and the art team has some time. So let's reinforce kind of the tone or the theme, because each region had like a narrative theme of this world. And so like we had like a document that was just like, I don't remember, it was called like a list of sadness, basically, because most of the vignettes were just like very tragic. I've already lost the question.
I'm curious, Teddy, did you ever play test for that kind of story comprehension or player feeling? Like, was that something you ever asked your playtesters?
Totally. Yeah, like second year, most of the second year we did a bi-weekly playtest. And in this case, I mean every 2 weeks, not twice a week, where like the end of every kind of production sprint on a Friday, we'd have somebody play the game for like 2 hours and then we'd just talk to them. And usually that was an area we hit, especially as we were sort of building out the regions, was like, what do you think happened here? How did you feel when you were walking through it? What do you remember? You know, that's always a big thing. It's like, what do you actually remember? What stood out to you? That's maybe more pacing, but that was a huge thing. It was like, because we did have these backstories and these current stories for every region, and we were like, they're not going to understand it. They're not going to know what's going on. And maybe that's okay, but we were definitely curious to know how much they were getting it. And as it went on, like we actually did see people getting it right. And I was like, cool. Like we wouldn't tell them that. That's our style, but I'd be like, oh, interesting.
Were you course correcting when you did hear like wildly wrong interpretations, or did you kind of like roll it off? And like, what was your like fix, like your action item when you got out of a playtest like that?
Oh, that's a good question. Usually the action item was make it simpler.
Oh yeah.
Almost always, because they would cross the streams and get two things confused, or they just like wouldn't remember really important beats. It was like, oh, we're just this, there's too much level, like the world's too big, let's cut level space, or we have too many themes going on here, they don't understand what's going on. Like even elementally we had a huge problem, because like God, I'm even going to lose track of it, but like every region had like one use of Hyperlight,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and what that translated into, and like one use of it that sort of, and a demonstration of sort of a corruption of it. But the East had like two, and at 1.3, and it was just too complicated, like to get anyone to understand what the hell was going on.
Yeah, to selfishly bring it back into puzzle design, actually, that is very similar to how a puzzle gets playtested too. Because almost always you put it in the hands of a player and there are too many steps and there are too many connections you're asking them to make. And it's very easy to do that as a designer, to add a lot of steps, because you know the mechanics, you're working with them, you have a certain way of thinking about them. And I think even most seasoned designers make a puzzle and put it in a virgin player's hands and are surprised by how hard it is for them to make connections like that. So that's cool that it's kind of from a narrative perspective, but it's definitely mm-hmm. something I see on like a more puzzle perspective as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's all like the psychology of just getting in players' heads and guiding their experience through whatever
right.
puzzle challenge or narrative understanding.
Yeah, Erin Hoffman has a great theory of fun, I think she called it. Basically, just kind of Piaget's developmental theory about learning and teaching. And so it's all about gradual dissemination of knowledge so that the learner, or in our case, the player, feels like they are learning something or getting better at a skill in their game gradually and like by themselves, that they aren't getting fed it. Because like, and she gives the example of like teenagers getting taught in school, you see them getting very bored when they're just getting lectured at. Whereas when you engage students and you let them kind of learn from themselves and learn things in a context that has meaning to them, they're much more engaged. And so when you have a player that's engaged and is learning things from themselves, they're internalizing things a lot more and a lot more effectively. So that's a big cornerstone of when I approach puzzles. I really look at it as though I'm teaching a class, which is the most academic thing to say, but I think it works.
I was going to ask before, when you were dealing with playtesting for puzzles, did you ever get into a situation where like, no, the player's just stupid and we're not going to change anything?
When you have a volume of playtesters,
yeah.
You can kind of make that call. If there's just one guy who just doesn't get it, you kind of just say, okay, sorry, dude. Or you look at that guy and say, okay, where was he getting tripped up? Like, is there a object in the world that's just too shiny and he really was convinced that was part of the puzzle? Is there any way we can avoid something like that?
That's the same for getting notes on anything.
Yeah, exactly. Like, look at the quorum.
If one person doesn't like it, you don't need to listen to them, but if it's a bunch of people, you should look at, see if it's like, what's the root of the problem?
Yeah, it's still valid in that it might have it might be a symptom of something, and they might just be wildly reacting to it in a way that's completely just not making the game usable for them. But they at least might have sniffed out something that is problematic. I think more often than not, it's something that some players may have like looked at but then ignored, but then, you know, 1 out of 10 people looks at it and gets fixated on it and gets very confused. So yeah, it's all about just keeping perspective in your player base.
So a question for both of you. If you had to recommend a book or other form of media to people making games that would help them understand storytelling better that isn't about game development, what would it be?
Oh, man. I mean, actually, I always tell game developers to read Understanding Comics by Scott McCloud.
I was just going to say that.
Yeah, that book, and there's also another book. I don't remember the author's name, but the book is called The 5 C's of Cinematography. And that book is beaten up, all screwed up, spines half falling apart on my desk at work, wherever I go, because I'm always looking at it. It is a phenomenal book just about the basics of cinematic storytelling.
Why is Scott McCloud's book amazing?
So his is also about, what I like about Scott McCloud is his book is very much about your reader and your relationship with that reader. So the same way we were talking about earlier about the designer talking to their player, Scott McCloud's very much about the comic book artist talking to their reader and getting information across.
I think a lot about television because like I almost went into television and I'm obsessed with that type of storytelling. Yay, episodic. And I find like so much parity or so many parallels between like the experience through especially a large game and your experience through a television show. But something that like I learned a lot from is a couple of different J.J. Abrams series. Pick your poison. Like if you don't want to watch Lost, that's fine. Watch Alias or watch Felicity, which is me going in reverse order. So J.J. Abrams' show ran Felicity and then Alias, and then he didn't really show run most of Lost, but he wrote the pilot, right? Or he directed the pilot. But yeah. The thing that I love, the piece of storytelling that I always hang on to that I learned from those shows is that they're not afraid to spend what they build up, and they're like very actively changing the setup every season or like every arc. So like there are shows or games that have a symptom of like they set up this one thing and it's so juicy, this one like plot development that they're hanging over your head that they won't let it pay off. Cause like, well, once we pay this off, like we've spent our thing. Like Red Dead Redemption is kind of like that, even though I love that game so much. But the not today John Marsden meme is your character John Marsden having one goal and like just over and over and over for however long your experience is, 10 to 20 hours, people being like, yo, I'll help you like get what you need, John Marsden. And then he's like, okay, I'll do what you want. And then you do it and they're like, sorry, I lied. And you're like, well, what the fuck? Like, pay it off. And so I look at Alias as a great example of that because they change the setup. Like, they set up something and then they always knock it down at the end of every season. And the show doesn't change. The show is always still formulaically like Jennifer Garner goes on spy missions. But the cast cycle in terms of their roles in the series, like who becomes the main villain and like the guy in Sloane, the character who's the main villain in the first season becomes a very different character throughout and like has a whole journey. But that show is always changing. Prison Break does that really well for me too. Like Prison Break is a show where like season after season, it is always sort of a heist formula. But they don't rest on like I don't want to spoil it, but it's like it's not 5 or 6 seasons about will they break out of the prison. Like, they break out of the prison. Like, it, I think at the end of season one. Yeah, sorry.
They like, break out in Prison Break?
Exactly. But season one is like, oh, like they're in this prison. And then at the end of season one, it's like, yep, they break out of the prison.
But life is the real prison.
Well, so, yeah, I mean, like, the show remains what you buy into. The show remains like, I want to watch this show where people are like colluding and like trying to make this plan to pull off this thing and like trick people. And there's, you know, that always remains. And every new season has a new version of a quote unquote Prison Break, whether it be a literal one or not, but they don't rest on that setup. And so like when it comes for me to storytelling and particularly with games, when they are long, like trying to change the setup is important.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of confidence that has to be built when you do something like that, when like you do have this really juicy twist or this really juicy payoff and letting it go. It's kind of another form of kill your babies in my mind. And it's actually something I see a lot working with Matt Stone and Trey Parker, is that they will think of a joke and will get that joke and be like, holy shit, this is the funniest joke I've ever read. Oh my God, this is so funny. We have to hold it to like act three. Like we gotta wait. Like we gotta put the zinger. And they will actively say, no, we want to like, why? Why would we hold this joke? It's so good. And so they always look at it as there will always be more jokes. There will always be more fun things to give to the viewer, experiencer, player, et cetera. Why hold your good work? Show it to your viewer. And I really love that. Like that's actually probably one of the most valuable lessons I've learned in this project so far is, don't be precious. Like the same way you can't kill it, you should be able to kill your babies if they're not working. You need to be able to let your good ideas be free and be experienced.
Before Jolie gets lynched, she's not talking about literal babies. That's like a shorthand, at least. I don't know if that's enough.
Oh yeah, I guess people don't know that. I always like take that for granted.
Do you want to elaborate?
Yeah.
Would you like to elaborate?
Killing your babies is kind of a term that I heard in my visual storytelling classes, which is, people often come into a project with like what they perceive as the linchpin idea or the twist, the best idea they've had. And it's kind of the cornerstone of their work. But then as developed the work further, the work might evolve past their initial idea, or it might evolve to a place where their initial idea doesn't really fit. And it's very important to kind of have the soundness of mind to say, okay, I know I was in love with this idea in the past, but my story is so much stronger now without it, or I'm making a lot of concessions to my story to keep this idea in when it's really not worth it. Even though it's my baby, I have to kill it.
When you're talking about Red Dead before, would Red Dead be a better story if it was like several hours shorter and several missions less?
You do more than 7 missions.
Maybe. But there are things about the length that I do like. Like, there are things that it benefits from. Like, when you when you go to Mexico and the way they do such a world change on you, like that wouldn't be as effective if I hadn't spent like at least whatever 6 or 8 hours that I've spent on the US side. So like there is something about time spent. I think, I don't know. I think it's just about like not leaning. If you're gonna, it's okay to have like a major MacGuffin, right? Like it's okay that they don't necessarily use that up. It's just that they lean so heavily on it that it's like always the thing.
I also think Red Dead's like a weird case too, where it kind of gets in a little narrative dissonance where John is trying to be above all of this, not going back to his dark ways, but like, all right, I guess I will kill someone again or do some bad shit.
Yeah, that was always the heartbreaking thing about GTA 4 as well, because there is a really beautiful narrative about an immigrant really having to be driven to crime to survive in his new environment. But then it just goes like totally off the rails when you start looking at the mechanics and go into the open world.
So last question, both of you, what's exciting about the future of storytelling in games?
VR.
Is it really?
No. I think there's a lot to do in VR. I keep having this dream of Sleep No More in VR. If you guys ever, I don't know if you guys ever did Sleep No More. It's like this interactive dance performance, basically, that's in this 5-story warehouse. The production that's I saw amazing. Was in New York. And it's astounding because you have a narrative that goes on for the night. I think you're in there for like 3 hours or something, right? But you can just follow whatever part of the story you want to. There's concurrent stories happening throughout the production, and you can just choose. There's like different ways to experience it. You can kind of just wander and see what you see. Some people follow a specific character and try to follow their story arc throughout the entire greater story. You can camp out in one place and just kind of see what happens in that specific place. And there's just so many different ways to experience that. But the bummer is that it has to take place in a very large warehouse. Whereas, you know, if you did something like that in VR, you have infinite space. Granted, it's a little more, it's harder to do the kind of follow the character around or wander around mechanic unless you have something like a Vive with a treadmill or something. But you'd at least have that kind of sitting in a train station and watching people go by. Possibility.
I think Sleep No More has been mentioned a dozen times on this podcast, different episodes now.
Oh yeah, it's probably pretty hackneyed at this point, but it's really good.
Like something that every game designer, I guess, thinks about or loves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm really excited for format experimentation, because like we're so young in the medium's situation of digital distribution being both like commonplace and widely available. Like this is, at least in terms of consoles, this is effectively the first generation. Like PS3 and Xbox 360, you could download games, but fewer people in the world had broadband. You know, like that's, at this point, it's much more common. Like the moving further and further away from the standard of a game has to be produced on a disc. That sounds like it's not new, but it relatively is. You know, like we're in the first decade of that as a distribution medium, so to speak. So like you could not have games like Gone Home. You could not have games like the Telltale games. You couldn't have games like episodic stuff or just short experiences because they wouldn't justify the disc production. Things like, you can fuck with the length of an experience or where you experience it or do you experience it all at once or in different parts and how has that played out? Like, I find that to be like wildly unexplored.
Is anything exploring it right now?
I mean, seeing Hitman be episodic is exciting.
Yeah.
Like, coming from a world where episodic seemed like the correct choice, like, I really enjoyed working in the episodic format, and I'm excited to see, you know, AAA studios actually undertaking that for the reasons Teddy just mentioned of we can do it now, we can distribute that way. It's very effective monetarily. It's awesome.
Yeah, episodic alone, like, even that sounds old hat, but it's super not, you know, like, that is absolutely the exception to the rule. And if you think about, you know, if you want to boil it down to like an unfair analogy, you compare film to television. It's like, we just got our television,
mm-hmm.
which is unfair because like, you know, the Sam and Max series has been around for a very long time, but that was such an outlier. And Telltale really, I think, convinced a lot of people that they could do it, thank God, so that
It's, and then Valve scared them away.
Oh, with the Half-Life episodes?
Yeah.
It's not really.
It's yeah, I feel like you need from the get-go. That's why I'm so excited about Hitman, because they are from the get-go excited and making an episodic format game. I think a few games have dabbled in kind of missions, like episodic missions. And we were talking earlier about Uncharted. You know, Uncharted 4 has these kind of mission packs that are planned for the DLC. Mm. Fallout 4 has something similar. And that's really cool, and it's a great format because it's a little piece of content you can kind of bite off and just play. But seeing a game go from the beginning with that format in mind is very exciting, a great direction.
Yeah.
Hitman's a unique case because it's one of the few, maybe the only one I could think of for an episode game where it being broken up, I think, benefits the gameplay because they're all sandbox environments and people get the chance, they would explore the game more than they would have if it had all just been put out at once.
Mm-hmm.
Which I don't know if you could really say about like Telltale games.
I think people need to get used to the format too, though. I think like that was every YouTube video we put out at Telltale, it was people saying, I'm waiting till the season pass. I'm waiting till the season's out. I'm waiting till the season's out. But then people would kind of dip their toe in actually playing them. A lot of people like hit that threshold of like, okay, I can't wait anymore. And I think this happened with Kentucky Route Zero as well, because people just got tired of waiting for Kentucky Route Zero. They started playing it and they're like, oh, actually there is some merit to this being episodic. There is a merit to experiencing a game and putting it down.
Yeah.
Jolie, do you know if people, because we only play Telltale games after they came out all together, for each like episode, would people play a game multiple times, or would they just do one playthrough and stick with that because they wanted to see how their choices impacted the other episodes?
I think a lot of people, actually a few people I talked to, would buy it on multiple platforms and then have their one platform that was like their master platform, their this is my story, this is my choices, and then you'd have the other platform that was their kind of like sandbox. They're kind of, okay, I'm just gonna go crazy, I'm gonna like be a racist asshole, I'm gonna be a jerk, and just see where it got them. So I definitely met a lot of players who were very, actually, yeah, like very precious about their save games and very concerned with their Lee or their Bigby or their recent Fiona.
I would love it if replayability would just die as a term in our industry, because like I just have this like there's so much good shit out there to consume and like to experience. It's like we put a new game plus in Hyperlight, and like I kind of like that for me, that was like drag kicking and screaming, but we were kind of, that's feeding into a thing that people expect and that they really want. But like, it's like, especially with the internet, let's talk about like the internet, like that people get to interact with each other and share their stories and talk about that. Like, you don't need to replay those games because you've had your experience. And that's like, so I think that's much more valuable than having all the experiences, you know, like what would be in, it's much less interesting to just like, here's a story map of like every possible branch of the story in Telltale. Like, people kind of want to know that. And maybe they're going to look it up, but I don't know. I don't like people replaying anything. I'm like, go do something else now.
It's not like a metric for anything else. Like, no one reviews books like, I could really reread this book.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Right, yeah.
This is accepted as like, this is a good book. I'll get more out of it if I do read it again.
Mm.
But it's not like, you don't, I'm not going to score this book higher because
this man, I can totally read this again.
Yeah, or it's, or you know that, that is an exception to the rule. Like, I'm gonna read this again or watch this again because there's a particular thing. You know, like, I'll tell people, like, oh, I love The Prestige because, like, watching it the second time is really interesting experience. But that's, like, due to the particulars, the way that story is written and what it's about. Like,
yeah.
And I think to your point earlier about just format and the medium evolving in its formats, I think the players are going to get used to these kind of single, like, one-off experiences because, yeah, until we had digital downloads and we could have our gun homes and our firewatches, it wasn't viable to have these short experiences. So I think as more short experiences happen and they're positive ones, I'm hoping replayability will be kind of a term that falls out of favor
or just falls out of the artifact.
Mm-hmm.
It's an artifact from like high investment economy of games where it's like, well, I'm going to spend $70. $70 like 15 years ago, which is way more than $70. Like, a game would cost like $80 or $90 today. And it's like, well, I better damn well have replayability because I spent so much. Like, that's my allowance for the next like 6 months.
Or I have nothing to play other than this, you know. I got Pokemon and that came out, and there's another Pokemon coming out in a year or two. And that's it.
Right now, I'm like, they just announced the new Pokemon starter. So I'm like, wait, we're on a new Pokemon? I missed the last Pokemon. There's so much good stuff out there.
You gotta catch them all, Teddy.
Gotta catch all the content.
And you can catch this podcast in a couple of weeks because we're going to end this episode.
Woo.
With that said, segway. Where can people find you two on the internet?
I am at... I'm on Twitter at Jolie Menzel, J-O-L-I-E-M-E-N-Z-E-L.
I'm Teddy Deef, T-E-D-D-Y-D-I-E-F on pretty much everything, which I guess is just Twitter and, I don't know, Snapchat. I'm trying Snapchat now. Get on my snaps. Check Chris. Out my stories.
Hashtag content.
Mm-hmm. You can plug your podcast.
Oh, yeah, I have a podcast, too. Playscape, which is available on podcast apps. So you should do that, too. And you can play Hyperlight Drifter. Are we plugging things? I just plugged everything.
Sure. So. It'll be linked in the show notes anyway.
Cool, great.
And, yeah, you can find our Twitter account at ScriptLockCast. And that's it. Thank you both for coming on.
Thanks for having us.